So welcome everyone who's logged in. Thanks for joining us. And welcome back to our Zoom Equipping Hour. Thanks for rolling with the unique circumstances. And we're still glad for the opportunity to continue learning from God's Word and the topic of the wisdom literature, continuing our study. And so we've gone through Proverbs and Job, and now we're on Ecclesiastes, where Jeff's going to lead us the first of two Sundays. So why don't you take it away, Jeff?
That sounds good. Well, I'll start with opening us in prayer and we'll get started. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this time we are able to gather, even if it's virtually. We thank you for the technology that allows us to do this. We obviously yearn for the time to be together physically, but we're just grateful for this time that we have this evening. And I pray that you would help me to deliver just this content effectively and carefully, and just help it to be just instructive and helpful for others, and just pray that you would bless our time together around your word. In Jesus' name, amen. Mm-hmm. All right. So a couple of things first off, just as we get set up here. It's not going to look like I'm looking at the camera the whole time, because my camera's at the very bottom of my laptop, and it's just a little awkward to look straight down there. So I'm not looking over you, I promise. But just wanted to get that out of the way. And then I am wanting this to still be a fairly interactive class, just like when I teach during normal equipping hour. So if you have questions, please feel free to, you know, raise a hand, put it in the chat that you have a question, or I don't mind if you just unmute yourself and say, hey, I have a question, Jeff, real quick, and interrupt me in that way. That's fine, too. Just don't all do it at once, I think. But I think it should be good. So we're going to start with Ecclesiastes here, and basically we're doing 2 weeks on this. The first week today, I'm really going to try to overview the book and just really hit on this kind of summary points and the summary aspect of the book. What is the book? What are its main themes? How do they unfold itself? How do we begin to interpret it? And then my plan for then is next week to really get into some of the application. How can we use this book in a more like day-to-day kind of a thing? So if you have some application questions, we can talk about some of that today if we have time, but I'm really going to try to strive for really hitting on just what is this book about. All right, so let's just kind of get started with that. In terms of the book itself, we have 12 chapters. The genre is a little bit hard to define. It's kind of autobiography, reflection. Kind of obviously, there's some similarities to the Proverbs in some of it, in the way that it's kind of got proverbial little nuggets thrown out there. But it's kind of a hard book to quantify in terms of what exact genre it is. Traditionally, this book is seen to be authored by Solomon, but some more contemporary scholarship has really cast doubt on this. And so it's really unsure who the author is. And so it could be seen in a number of different ways. And so we're not really sure. But the end result is it's all inspired by the Holy Spirit. So it's God's word, and we can just kind of take it at that. Obviously, if we had a specific author, God wanted us to know who it was, we would know. But we don't. And so we just have to take the words for what they are as we see them in scripture. And then really one of the things, if you look at the handout there, is the purpose of this book. It's really to help God's people struggle with meaning of life in a fallen, broken world. And I think all of us can probably identify with that struggle. I know that's something that I've talked about a lot with Lucy and even with my kids at points and others who are, you know, believers and unbelievers, just struggling with the fallenness of this world and how it's just a kind of a horrific place sometimes. And so this is a book that's kind of written to help as people deal with that aspect of this world, is that it is not always a good place. And so this book answers some of the big questions of life, like what is our purpose here? How do we, how do we deal with tragedy in this world and things like that? And so this is a really helpful book as we can start kind of gleaning information from it. It can be really helpful. And so I want to kind of get started into the actual kind of lesson now, just really kind of looking at the text itself. And so if you look at your handout there, if you're looking at it, if not, I'll walk through it either way. But there are really kind of three main movements in this text, is what I would call them, three main sections. And if I could have a couple of volunteers to read just a few passages, I need three volunteers.
I'll read.
All right. So is that Patty, I think I heard?
Okay. That's right.
Read the verses 1 to 11 in chapter 1.
I'll do it.
Is that Tim? Or who was? Oh, is that Matt? Matt. Okay. Yes. Matt, if you could read verses 12 to 17 in chapter 1. And then one more person.
I can do it. This is John.
John? Okay, thanks, John. If you could read verses 9 to 10 in chapter 12. So Ecclesiastes 12, verses 9 and 10. And so start with verses 1 to 11 with Patty. And so as these people are reading these verses, if everybody else just kind of be listening or following along, we're going to be reading most of the first of chapter 1 of Ecclesiastes and the last kind of almost the last two verses of chapter 12 at the end of the book, and just kind of be listening along. And I'm going to ask a question about noticing the differences or a specific difference you're noticing between these different passages. So go ahead, Patty.
I'm unmuted. I apologize. I'm old also. This is from the Inspired New American Standard version of the Bible. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What advantage does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Also, the sun rises and the sun sets, and hastening to its place, it rises there again. Blowing toward the south, then turning toward the north, the wind continues swirling along, and on its circular courses, the wind returns. All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. All things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is that which will be, and that which has been done is that which will be done. So there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one might say, see, it is new? Already it has existed for ages which were before us. There is no remembrance of earlier things, and also of the later things which will occur. There will be for them no remembrance among those who will come later still.
All right. Thank you. So, Matt, if you could read verses 12 to 17.
12 to 17. I, the preacher, have been given king over Israel and Jerusalem. And I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is but a striving after wind.
Thank you. And then John will read verses 9 and 10 of chapter 12. And kind of again, as John's reading this, be thinking about what you heard Matt read and Patty read, and kind of looking at, do you notice any real difference in any aspect of these verses here? Go ahead, John.
Besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth.
All right, thank you. So my first question, I guess, then is, what I was just asking, is there any specific difference anybody noticed or picked up on between one section of that reading versus the other two? An important distinction I want to make at the very beginning of this lesson. Sam. Maybe not. I thought he needed himself to talk, but maybe not. So anybody notice any difference there? You can raise a hand, put it in the chat, or just speak it out.
I could just say that the chapter 12 passage sounds a little bit more optimistic. Like those words of delight, everything seems a little more jaded in chapter one.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. I'm even not even thinking about the content. What I'm really looking at, if I guess I'll just tell you guys, look at the point of view. There are three, or really the first section that Patty read and the section that John read, you notice they are third person. The words of the preacher are this. If you look at chapter 12, what John read, I'll read it again. The preacher sought, besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge. And then verse 10, the preacher sought to find words of delight. And if you compare that to what Matt read, starting in verse 12 of chapter 1, I said in my heart, I have acquired wisdom, I applied my heart. So there's really three different sections here, three movements. The prologue of this book is verses 1 to 11 in chapter 1. And it's a third person kind of introduction almost. And then you have from chapter 1, verse 12, all the way through the almost the end of the book, chapter 12, verse 7, you've got a narrative. And it's a first person account, a first person narrative explaining the actions of this preacher. And then at the very end of the book, again, in verses 8 to 14 of chapter 12, you've got what we call the epilogue. And this is, again, a third-person perspective. And there's some discussion here of, is it the same person changing points of view and saying, you know, I did these things, and then kind of reflecting back in the third-person kind of a sense of saying, oh, and he did this, even when he means himself. It could be that. There's a little bit of awkwardness there if that's the case, but it could be. There are some other points in the text where in the first person perspective where somebody's speaking and then it's interrupted by a third person, which again would be a little awkward. So the wisdom seems to be that it could be one person writing, reflecting on their own experiences, but it's most likely two separate people or two separate authors in some ways. But either way, again, just like the authorship of the book, it's not 100% clear. And so we're not to put too much stock into it. If it was one person writing, it's important to recognize that there's going to be some different, maybe the author was writing this at different points in his life. And so in the middle of the book, he's, you know, really struggling through knowing God, knowing, you know, just being feeling close to God. And we'll talk about that a little bit. But he's struggling with sin. He's dealing with, you know, worldly things. And if that's the case, he's maybe writing that section about a time in his life when he was struggling. Whereas at the end of the book, when he concludes the book with the reflection on God himself, then it's going to be from a different point of view in that sense. And so I want to just make that clear, because otherwise this could get a little bit confusing as you're reading through it, as we're talking through it, as you're seeing this preacher struggling and saying things that seem, you know, to disagree with one another, you know, making statements that seem to contradict themselves, maybe. But you just have to kind of read it in these different ways, like not quite different ways, but just different perspectives almost. So the prologue, we're going to start really kind of getting into now and really discussing the prologue a little more specifically. And then we'll move into the narrative itself. Most of our time will not be spent on the longer part of the narrative today. We'll touch through the summary aspects of that, but that's what I want to really get into next week, because this is where all the nitty-gritty kind of specific nuggets are, and I want to get into the application next week. So we will talk about the narrative, just kind of hitting here are the main points of it, but really we're going to focus on the prologue, introducing the text, run through some of the narrative fairly quickly, and then hit the epilogue where it kind of reflects back on the preacher's narrative. And so let's move into the prologue here, the very beginning of the book. And so kind of starting with in verse 1 of Ecclesiastes chapter 1, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem. You can obviously see from that why a lot of people traditionally even have thought this was Solomon, and even still some contemporary scholars do, but there's some debate on that. You know, the son of David, king of Jerusalem, writer of wisdom literature, would make sense that would be Solomon. So there's this, what we call a superscription, and this is just introducing the preacher, introducing this speaker that's going to be talking throughout the rest of the book. And then verse 2 is really kind of the motto of the entire book. And this is kind of probably one of the more famous verses out of the Ecclesiastes. But vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And so this is an important word that I want to take a little bit of time to just talk through a little bit. This word vanity could mean many things. So what are some of the kind of primary uses we would think of would be things like fleeting, transient, kind of hard to grasp, incomprehensible, enigmatic or mysterious, futile, purposeless, meaningless? These are a number of the different ways this word is actually used in the text, kind of metaphorically. Really, it's the same word, the same Hebrew word, hevel. I might be mispronouncing that, but H-E-B-E-L is the way it's spelled out, hevel. And it's the word breath. It's the same as used in Isaiah chapter 57 in verse 13, which I'll just read real quickly instead of asking somebody to read just for the sake of ease. So Isaiah 57, 13, the verse reads, "When you cry out, let your collection of idols deliver you. The wind will carry them off. A breath will take them away." So that word breath, that word wind, is the kind of the word that is used here in Ecclesiastes over and over and over again for vanity. And so this word is used throughout the book. It's the most used word in the entire book. And so it's the primary way that the preacher here is going to describe life is breath, is vanity. And so it's an important word to kind of just introduce really briefly here. As like I said, as it is really the motto of this book. And so that's an important word to introduce. And then the other one is the word for preacher. Even what we see in verse 1, the word of the preacher, and then that word is used over and over again. It's really a word that means preacher or teacher, one who gathers people. And what's important to look at here with this word preacher and who this person is to look at the journey that this person goes on in the book of Ecclesiastes. And because we don't know who this person is necessarily, and so I kind of just going to keep referring to him as the preacher. Kind of if you would maybe remember back when Pastor Greg was preaching out of Hebrews, just referring to the preacher, because we just don't know who it is. So there are really kind of three different ways to view this preacher's journey as we get into it. Like I mentioned, he has this first-person narrative that takes up most of the book. And so depending on how we view the narrative itself, it's going to kind of change how we interpret the text. So there's really three different ways, and I'll mention all three, but then I'll tell you which one I kind of fall into. So there's one that's the heterodox preacher, which is really kind of where the preacher is deviating from orthodox wisdom literature. You can even think of, you know, the Proverbs, deviating from that wisdom and then dealing with the interpretations of that. Then there's the second way, which would be the orthodox preacher, where this is a preacher who is preaching and taking on orthodox literature, orthodox wisdom, where the positive statements in the book really take precedence over the negative. Even though there's a lot of negativity expressed during his narrative, we take the positive aspects of it, especially connecting towards God and towards wisdom and different things like that. I don't think either of those two are the best way to approach it, though. I think the best way to view this journey is the struggling preacher. This is a kind of a first person account of someone struggling through living in the fallen world. And it's them trying to reconcile and satisfy themselves apart from God and reconcile just the fallenness of the world with life. And they're struggling. And the entire book is just a long struggle. And really until the very end of the book, where it goes back to that third person narration again, where somebody's reflecting back on the words that this first person account was dealing with. And I think that's the best way to kind of view this. It shows the honest struggle of how to exist and understand life in a fallen world. So it's kind of probably, I've been imagining for a lot of you, it's a struggle you have. And so this book really, I think, can help us to know how to situate ourselves as we think through these things. Because I know even as we think of some, you know, tragedies that even are happening that we're dealing with in our, with this, the COVID-19 virus, it's a it's a hard thing to situate ourselves in. And so this is, I think, the best way to look at it. I think it's the most accurate, and it's the way that it makes the most sense. And so, again, kind of looking at this in terms of just, this is somebody struggling through many of the same questions you probably have. And we'll walk through some of those a little bit today, but really get into those next week. And so we've got verse 1, which is kind of that superscription, just introducing the preacher. Verse 2 in chapter 1 is the motto of the book, that all is vanity. And then in verse 3, we really have kind of the key question of this book. And verse 3 says, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? And so I guess this is where I want to ask a question to have somebody respond. What's the important phrase to focus on in that question? What important word or phrase kind of stands out to some, to any of you, as the thing to focus on in that question?
Under the sun?
Under the sun, yeah. Why did you say that, John? Because I agree.
Because it limits the question. It limits, like, what does man gain by all the toil he toils under the sun? So it limits it to this life.
Exactly. The this life aspect of it, I think, is the important part. You're right. Because, yeah, it limits, you know, what does man gain by toil? That's a very open-ended question. But when we focus the parameters of this question is by the, all the toil we do under the sun. But this is an important thing to focus on. And part of the reason we know it's important is this phrase, under the sun, appears 29 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. This is a major concern for the preacher here. And so he relies heavily on this phrase. And so we want to pay attention to that. And it is important that we focus the aspect on this. Sorry, we focus our attention on the preacher's paying attention to only things under the sun, not heavenly things, only earthly things here. And so really, that's one of the things you're going to notice as we go through the narrative, starting in verse 12 of chapter 1, all the way through the almost the end of the book here, is the preacher's focus is on the worldly things, things outside of God. And by that, by outside of God, I mean they're not, obviously God is in control of it all, but he's not viewing God in connection with these things. He's trying to solve his problems in a worldly way with worldly intelligence, worldly wisdom, worldly experience, kind of really paying attention away from God. Okay, so yeah, I see Daniel just had a question there. Are there some other possibilities? Yeah. There are a few people who have been thought of as here, their possible options, but really it seems like the the consensus is that it's somebody trying to connect it back towards Solomon in some ways, of saying if Solomon struggled with these things, or if even somebody as great as Solomon was, as wise as Solomon was, still struggled with sin, so could all of us. And so there seems to be kind of not trying to be Solomon, but connect back to Solomon. Maybe Tim, you mentioned something the other day. You were doing some research on this, trying to help me out with this question. Did you come across anything specific in your research about that?
Well, yeah. It seems like either Solomon himself is writing, or it's another later author who is writing it as though he were Solomon, not pretending to be Solomon, but basically recounting Solomon's words and his teaching in maybe more, because some of the scholars look at, you know, more later kind of vocabulary and things like that, which is kind of hard to pin down exactly. But it's not someone lying and pretending to be Solomon. So it would either be Solomon himself or somebody kind of recounting Solomon's teaching later.
Yeah, and there's, you know, in terms of the reasons why people think it's not Solomon, I can, you know, we can definitely talk more about that if we have time at the end. But a lot of it deals with just language use in the book. The language is much more advanced than other stuff written during the time of Solomon. It's just the language is at a different state, really. So the language during the time of Solomon doesn't really fit. There are some other places where specific points in the text where being if it was Solomon, some of the statements don't quite make sense, you know, such as, you know, having no ability to help, you know, deal with injustice. If it was Solomon writing this, Solomon has the ability to deal with injustice in an earthly way, it seems. And so there's some other questions like that, but it's definitely something I'm still not quite sure where I fall. MacArthur and Rick Holland both said it's obviously Solomon. Others, you know, introductions to the book and different things I've read have said it's not. So we're not quite sure though. But yeah, I think it's an important question, because if it is Solomon, or either way, it's somebody recounting Solomon, it seems, if it's not him. But yeah, I think that's a good question. So going back to that question though, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? So that is the important thing. It focuses the reader's attention on the world instead of the heavenly realm. And that's what the preacher is doing. It's limiting his thoughts to the earth and doesn't bring God into the picture, even when the opportunity is ripe for him to do so, it seems, in the first person narrative. And one of the things I thought it does when you think about under the sun, that aspect of looking at a fallen world without having a hope of Christ, it really helps me to think of and understand those who don't have that hope, who are not believers, and how they would try to deal with the reality of the harshness of this world, where we have horrific things happening, and we look at and you think, what's my purpose in life if it's not God? And I think this book gives us in a way an answer to that question of what that would look like for somebody struggling with it. And so, you know, as we go through some of first person narrative later, and just kind of seeing some of the phrases and some of the questions or some of the statements that this preacher makes, kind of have that in your mind as just a way to be thinking about this, because it definitely it made me kind of a little bit more empathetic in some ways towards that struggle, I think. So yeah, definitely think about that. I guess one of the questions I would also ask is, you know, we want to think, what does a man normally get from the toil, right? What does a man gain? What do we expect to gain something from toil, right? We expect profit. We expect to get more back. That's not really the case, though. The preacher kind of answers this question a little bit in chapter 2. I'll just read chapter 2, verses 10 and 11 really quickly. So chapter 2, verses 10 and 11. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. And then verse 11, then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So in reality, what does a man gain? The preacher here says nothing. All was striving after the wind. All was vanity. All he got really was whatever pleasure was given during the toil, during the act itself. That's what he got. And that's, again, when you think about it from the under the sun perspective, and that's an important thing to remember, as John pointed out, it limits the scope of that question. And so the reason I wanted to point out this kind of toil and profit connection is because the preacher very clearly says there is no profit. That question is answered under the sun. But he does say, and this is an important theme in the book, that there is a portion that we do get from life. And it's really that we should kind of enjoy what we have on this earth, you know, eating, drinking, some of the things he'll mention in there. We should enjoy them, because that's all that we get under the sun. And so as we especially get into the next week, we're going to be talking about some application stuff, and I'm going to be mentioning a couple of books that I've read that were really helpful. One's called Death by Living, which I'll promo at the end, and then another one was called Living Life Backwards, and they're really two similar books, but they're dealing with just the nitty-gritty of this book and how do we live and enjoy the life we have, knowing that it's futile, it's vanity. But we're obviously approaching it from a little bit of a different perspective at points as well, because we have hope beyond just the life under the sun. And so really that's kind of the first part of the prologue, is verses 1 to 3. We have the superscription, we've got the motto of the book, and we have this important key question. And then the rest of this first section is takes up a poem. It's verses 4 to 11. It's a poem that really paves the way for us to view the struggle of this preacher in the kind of that next section of the book here. But in this poem, if you looked at it, Patty read that earlier, it was just really talking about just the wind and different things, just this cyclical nature of things. But as you got later into the poem, and so starting in verse 8, all things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there's nothing new under the sun. And there's just kind of just everything's falling short. Nothing's quite what the expectation was. There's just a lack of satisfaction. Nothing's profiting the way it's supposed to. And this really kind of paves the way for the struggle that we're going to be looking at with this preacher for the rest of the book, pretty much. And so this poem's really helpful in that sense. It kind of gets the reader situated for what's about to come. And so then we go into the actual narrative, this first-person narrative. And one of the things I want to point out as we get into this narrative, though, is there's a little bit of a difference between Ecclesiastes and Proverbs. They're both wisdom literature, yes. In the role of what even is thought of as the word wisdom. The word wisdom is used in both books, but they're really not the same thing. In Proverbs, this is just a general question of how do you know something? In Proverbs, the answer is usually because I learned it, and it's wisdom in that sense. In Ecclesiastes, it's I observed it. And so there's a difference there in just in terms of how they arrive at the answers to life's questions. And the I observed it role in Ecclesiastes really stresses kind of experiential knowledge and rational intelligence and worldly knowledge to understand life. And so it's focusing on things under the sun, whereas obviously the knowledge, the wisdom in Proverbs is a godly wisdom. Right, rooted in, fear of God and the beginning of wisdom there. We can think about kind of what the proverb says about wisdom. But in Ecclesiastes, it's not. The wisdom here is not rooted in the fear of God. It's on experience and observation. And so that's one thing we're going to get into later is looking at the way that the preacher talks about God and what his views of God are. But we'll get to that in a little while. So really now let's kind of jump into the preacher's narrative. And so verse 12 of chapter 1, and this goes all the way through the end of the book almost, but there are really kind of two main parts, and you see these in the notes in your outline here. The first one is the search for meaning under the sun, and this really kind of takes over from verse 12 of chapter 1 all the way until the end of chapter 6. And so all of chapters 2 through 6 and then the latter half of chapter 1 is the search for meaning under the sun. Again, this is that phrase that we were looking at earlier. And so for this part, we're going to kind of hit through some of these pretty quickly, just for the sake of time. But we'll talk about them just a little bit. So the first one we're going to look at is chapter 2, verse 1 through 11, the vanity of self-indulgence. And so I'll read verse 1 here of chapter 2, for the sake of time, instead of asking somebody else to read it. But here we go. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this was also vanity. But I want to ask a question, I guess, is does anything interesting point out about this announcement, this statement to any of you? Does anything stand out as kind of interesting or unique here?
I think it's interesting that he tests his heart with pleasure. He doesn't just say, I will reward you with pleasure.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what stood out to me too, is there's a testing here. It's I don't know how to find meaning. I don't know how to answer that question of, for what is all of my toil on earth under the sun? He doesn't know. And so the answer is, I'm going to try to figure this out. And the way he's going to figure it out is by putting worldly things to the test. And we obviously can know from our perspective here that nothing's going to satisfy, right? Nothing will satisfy the meaning, because we can't find our meaning for our lives on this earth. And we know this, but the preacher here is going to search it out. And that's what we're going to see for these next five or six chapters, is the preacher just really indulging in every form of debauchery that you can imagine. Obviously, you can think about if this is Solomon, we obviously can look at that sense or look at Solomon's life and see these things coming through. But even if it's not, it doesn't matter, because we're seeing them described for us. So we have self-indulgence. And if we look later on in these verses, I'm going to kind of read like little sections of verses 1 to 11 here of chapter 2. But he says, I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks. I made myself pools which to water the forests of trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had great possessions of herds and flocks. I gathered silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, had many concubines, the delight of the children of man. I became great and surpassed all who were before me. So we can just see all the different ways that this preacher is trying to satisfy himself with these worldly things. And even we know from the very beginning of verse 1 of chapter 2, he says, this was also a vanity. We can see that word, that fleetingness of it, the futileness of it. You can think about the idea of breath, right? Trying to grasp a breath. You can't grasp the air. It's just going to slip through your fingers if you ever try to, I was trying to describe this to my daughter Wendy the other day, I think, and just trying to say, you can't grab it, right? It's just going to slip out of your hands. It's never going to be something you can grasp. And so we see this coming through here in the self-indulgence thing. Got a visitor. All right, Rose, go back to mommy. Go to mama, Rose. All right, well, Lucy will come get her, I'm sure. So the self-indulgence, it didn't work for him. So as we go to the next part, verses 12 to 17, we're going to change gears here. And self-indulgence didn't satisfy him. So what did he do next? We have the vanity of living wisely. You see that in your notes, maybe. And so I'll read verse 12 here. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. And so he's going to indulge himself in wisdom. He's going to pour himself into wisdom. And again, I want to stress that when the word Ecclesiastes, this word wisdom is not the way we would think of wisdom as in the Proverbs. There's a different focus to it, a different fundamental perspective difference. Is not godly wisdom. And so the preacher here is turning to wisdom. And obviously wisdom's a good thing. But even if you look at the end of the section in verse 17, in talking about wisdom, he says, so I hated life in verse 17, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after the wind. This search for wisdom didn't satisfy. He said, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. So that's the reason why. Why is wisdom not satisfactory? Because the end result is the fool and the wise person end up the same. They die, right? There is no difference in that in the long run. Obviously, in a short temporal time on earth, the fool has some advantage, or the wise person has some advantages over the fool, but that doesn't satisfy the need of this preacher. And you can look at some of the things that he said earlier on that we already read of, for this short time on earth and some of these things. And so it's just wisdom didn't satisfy, self-indulgence and every earthly pleasure didn't satisfy. And so why not? Why doesn't it satisfy? And so the preacher answers this question in verses 18 to 20 of chapter 2. So why don't these things satisfy him? And so verse 18, I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This is also vanity. And so at the end of verse 19 there, we can even stop. Why doesn't it matter? Because he's going to die and it's going to go to his son or somebody after him. And this could be somebody who's going to squander it all quickly. And there's no lasting impact for all of his wise choices that he may have made. There's nothing lasts because it's all temporal. He's looking at it from this under the sun perspective that's just always going to yield just this incomprehensible failure. And then so now we're going to kind of go up to the next chapter in chapter 3, just kind of skimming through here. And if you read chapter 3, it'll sound oddly familiar. And I'll just read it and you'll maybe smirk to yourself knowing what I mean. So chapter 3, for everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. If you are getting music notes popping into your head because it sounds like a song you've heard, then you're right, because it does come from there. But you can see the aspect of time and temporalness is really concerning to the preacher here. And that would make sense if we look at the things he's just tried and the ways that they have failed and not satisfied the preacher. And it's because of the fact that everybody's going to die. And that's an important starting place to understand, is we're all going to die at some point. And so anything that's just left on earth, if that's all we leave with us, we can see it's going to be vanity. It's going to be pointless and futile. And so if we look a little further down here, we're going to kind of look at what his conclusion is when he's come to the end of this just thought of time. He's going to see that that's just, it's not going to end up the way he wanted to. And so verse 9 of chapter 3, I'll read a little bit here. What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in his time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all of his toil. This is God's gift to man. And so this is one of those themes that I mentioned earlier here of enjoying what we have on this earth, because that's what we have. That's the gift from God that we have. But he mentions here that nothing can endure. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. So that's the next verse here. I'm going to start reading verse 14. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing can be, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. That which is has already been, that which is to be has already been, and God seeks what has been driven away. And so we see here the temporalness of man, the inability of man to do anything other than what God has given them. And then there's this truth statement about God that what God endures, endures forever. Nothing can be added or taken from it. God's done it, so people fear him. And this is an important kind of transitional point here. This is kind of one of the first places where a statement about God is made, and it's a true statement, but it's not necessarily from the same perspective as we were talking about with Proverbs in terms of the fear of God and what this fear actually looks like. And so if we were to look at what the preacher is talking about when he says in verse 14 that God has done it so that people fear before him, right? The fact that God is not temporal, the fact that God exists outside of that and his word and what he has done endures forever, inspires fear, is what the preacher is saying here. And that is true, right? That should in some ways. But the fear that it inspires is a little bit different. And so one of the things that was really interesting as I studied this book is the fact that the preacher here in Ecclesiastes never uses the term Yahweh. It's always Elohim. And does anybody know what's the significance of that, do you think? Why would that be, or what is some of the significance of the difference between those terms? And this is something we've talked about at church in the recent past. So what's the significance of the fact that the preacher doesn't use the name of God, Yahweh, but only the title of God, Elohim?
Yahweh is his covenantal name, and Elohim is just a standard name for God, just not outside of the covenant.
Yeah, and so why would that be significant? Maybe you can, Anna, you can jump back on, or somebody else, but why would that be significant that this preacher is only using that term, Elohim, throughout the entire text?
Perhaps he's distancing himself from God.
Yeah, so he could be, he's distancing himself from God, or it could be the kind of other side of it is he feels distant from God. Either way, there is a distance, right? There is not a closeness, a personalness, a personal connection to God, as you would see, you know, in Proverbs or other places in Scripture. And this would make sense, right? If we're looking at the struggling preacher, if somebody who's struggling in the fallen world, I can imagine feeling that way and not feeling like God is right there with you. I felt that in my life, right? When you maybe felt this too, when you're dealing with something that's hard and God doesn't feel close. You don't feel comforted, even though he is there, it just doesn't feel that way. And so that's an important thing to look at there. And so I want to look at that word fear a little bit more. So when we think of, you know, Proverbs and the way that Proverbs uses, you know, the word fear, you know, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. What does that word fear really mean? Because that's an important thing to kind of make a distinction here. So what does fear mean there? When we think of the proverbial sense of like the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. How would you translate that word fear maybe, or what synonym might you use?
I've heard it used as awe, the awe of God instead of fear.
Awe? Yeah, I think that's a good one, Paulette. I like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely like awe. Any others?
There's adoration and reverence are a couple of them too that people use.
Yeah, I agree. I would definitely use those terms. That the word I'm coming back to is reverence. I like that word. So fear is not the fear, like the terror-inspiring fear that we would think of. It's a reverence and an appreciation for the power, the majesty of God, but it's an appreciation of it. It's like Smokey used the word adoration. And I don't think that's the fear that the preacher in Ecclesiastes is using here. I think he's using much more close to that terror-inspired fear when you recognize that this God is not temporal. He has all power, but I'm not of the covenant with him or feeling close to him right now. That would inspire terror. And so that fear is important to understand how this preacher is feeling. And again, this is where I was mentioning earlier, where just understanding what it would be like to live in this fallen world apart from God, and having that, if you were to recognize there is a God, but you are not one of his children, that's the terror that would be the terror that I would be feeling. And so we have the recognition of time and the temporalness of everything. And then we go into chapter five, looking at fear and just the fallen nature of the world. I'm going to kind of be going through some of these pretty quickly. If you're on your outline, I'm looking at letters E and F of section one, evil under the sun in chapter four, the fear of God in chapter five. And then, so we have fear, we've got just the fallenness of the world, evil under the sun. Going into the end of chapter 5, and chapter 5, verse 8 through chapter 6, verse 12, where you begin looking at the vanity of wealth and honor. And so why might having wealth and honor and, you know, majesty and things in this life be vanity? Considering what we just talked about God. And just for the sake of time, I'll answer it. Just because I'm looking at the time, realizing you've got to move a little quickly. The reason that wealth and honor are vanity on this life is there's somebody who has more wealth and honor than you do, and that's God. The one to be feared in the previous section that we were looking at has more. And so what's the point? You're never going to be the top dog, essentially. You're always going to be second fiddle, second class to somebody else. And so really this kind of ends the first section of the preacher where it's talking about under the sun, the under the sun aspect of things. This is just the search for meaning. In the second half of the preacher's narrative, in this first person narrative here, we're going to be getting into wisdom versus folly and kind of really human ignorance and the human aspect of things here. And so going into chapter six, chapter seven of Ecclesiastes, the preacher begins contrasting folly and wisdom. And so I'm just going to read a little bit of chapter 7, starting in verse 14 of chapter 7 here. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. In the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. In my vain life, I have seen everything. There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in evil doing. Be not overly righteous and do not make yourself too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Be not overly wicked, neither be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you should take hold of this, and from that withhold not your hand, for the one who fears God shall come out from both of them. Wisdom gives strength to the wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. Surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. And so, again, a couple of verses later down, I'm going to go to verse 23. All this I have tested by wisdom. I said I will be wise, but it was far from me. That which has been is far off and deep, very deep. Who can find it out? So wisdom, again here, he's looking at worldly wisdom. And so he's starting from a wrong perspective even. But he realizes that worldly wisdom is pointless because you can't grasp everything. And also, God has made one as well as the other. And there's no earthly benefit, he says. You know, why should you destroy yourself and deprive yourself as a righteous man when you're going to die early and the wicked man will prolong his life by evil doing? It doesn't make any sense in this worldly perspective. And so it's really, there's not much difference in a lot of ways between the wise and the foolish in the preacher's perspective. Obviously, if we're looking at a godly wisdom, that's different. But in terms of just what the preacher's seeing in worldly wisdom, it doesn't really make any sense to pursue wisdom and to pursue righteousness. It doesn't, because there's no benefit to it. And there is, the preacher finally kind of at least recognizes some truths about God at different points. But one of them is in chapter 8, verses 12 to 13. Looking at kind of the fear of God again. So in chapter 8, verses 12 to 13, he says, though a sinner does evil 100 times and prolongs his life, yet I know that it will be well with those who fear God because they fear before him. But it will not be well with the wicked, neither will he prolong his days like a shadow because he does not fear before God. And so here is in chapter 8, it's kind of one of those, one of the first places the preacher doesn't just subject his thinking to the under the sun perspective. He's acknowledging God and bringing God into kind of the solution for his, in his search for wisdom or for satisfaction. But even then, it still has kind of a negative slant to it a little bit. And so you can still see he's still, this preacher is still struggling here in this narration. And then part of the reason he struggles is just a few verses later in chapter 8 of verse 16 and 17. It says, when I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done on earth, how neither day nor night do one's eyes see sleep. Then I saw all the work of God, that man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. However much man may toil in seeking, he will not find it out. Even though a wise man claims to know, he cannot find it out. And so part of the reason that wisdom and folly, again, there's not really that much of a difference between them, is God's wisdom is much higher, right? Man cannot find out the ways of God, no matter how much he searches. Even the wise claim to know, they can't know. And so kind of going through, again, fairly quickly, the last section of Ecclesiastes here, the search for wisdom and folly, the preacher comes to a conclusion, which he has made this statement, you know, more than anything else in the book. He says, all is vanity. And so I'm going to read kind of at the end of chapter 12 here in Ecclesiastes. Chapter 12, verses 1 to 7, I'm going to or 1 to 8. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain, in the day when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men are bent and the grinders cease because they are few, and those who look through the windows are dimmed and the doors on the street are shut, when the sound of the grinding is low and one rises up at the sound of a bird and all the daughters of song are brought low, they are afraid also of what is high, and terrors are in the way. The almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags itself along, and desire fails because man is going to his eternal home. And the mourners go about the streets before the silver cord is snapped or the golden bowl is broken or the pitcher is shattered at the fountain or the wheel broken at the cistern. And the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. And that's his conclusion. After searching the world over and every worldly pleasure, worldly wisdom, every, you know, wealth, honor, everything, his conclusion, and again, this is a phrase that's spoken more than anything else in the book, is vanity. It's grasping after the wind. It's futile. It's nothing we can comprehend or understand even fully. And that's his conclusion. And that ends the narrator, the first person narration, this person telling him his search for satisfaction in life. It ends there. All is vanity. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher. All is vanity. And this is where we have that third person perspective come back in. And this is what John, I think, read earlier. Besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. And so that may not sound that helpful. I'm reading from the ESV here. And as I was looking at that, I was a little confused by it. And so I went to the New King James Version. And when I read that, it made a lot more sense. And so I'm going to read from the New King James Version here, verses 8 to 12. And I think it will hopefully kind of that perspective, the reflection that the preacher is giving. That's what we're going to get here. Sorry, not the preacher. This third person narrator coming back and reflecting on the words of this preacher here. So here we go. And moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yes, he pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find acceptable words, and what was written was upright, words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads, and the words of scholars are like well-driven nails given by one shepherd. And further, my son, be admonished by these. Of making many books, there is no end, and much study is wearisome to the flesh. And so this is his reflection, this third person, whether it be he's reflecting on his own experiences or it's somebody reflecting on the experience of this preacher, of Solomon, whoever it might be, that he's reflecting on what was said. And he says, yes, these things are true. There's good things in them. But really, that's not the final conclusion of this third person narrator reflecting back on these experiences. Really, that comes in the last two verses of the text. And what they do is they answer that key question. Anybody remember what the key question was at the very beginning of the book? Please say it out loud for somebody.
What would man gain under the sun?
Yeah, what would man gain from all of his toils under the sun? And so the answer to this question is finally given in the last two verses, and this is in verses 13 and 14. The end of the matter, all has been heard. fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, whether with every secret thing, whether good or evil. And so really, the conclusion of the preacher is, or not of the preacher, of this narrator. All these things that this preacher wrote, yes, they were upright, but that's not what matters. You know, it ultimately, it comes not from under the sun that our satisfaction comes or our meaning is derived, right? Our meaning is derived from above the sun, right? The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God, keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. And so the duty of man that was being kind of looked into was under the sun. He was trying to find his duty, his purpose under the sun, and that was not going to work. And we see why here at the very end, because it comes from above. And so just in conclusion, as I wrap up here today, I want to do two things. I want to look at Psalm 73 very, very quickly. I think Psalm 73 is a good kind of Ecclesiastes in a microcosm, in a chapter, kind of encapsulates the struggle of the preacher, and I'll read through that in just a minute here. And I also want to give a couple of options for reading. I mentioned these are two books that I would recommend, and I'll get to those in just a second. So let me read Psalm 73, and I want you to listen and just see, where can you kind of see some similarities, or where can you see this idea of Psalm 73 being kind of a microcosm, a small picture of the whole book of Ecclesiastes, or of at least the struggle of the preacher. So Psalm 73, God is my strength and portion forever, a psalm of Asaph. Truly, God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped. For I was envious of the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. For they have no pangs until death. Their bodies are fat and sleek. They are not in trouble as others are. They are not stricken like the rest of mankind. Therefore, pride is their necklace. Violence covers them as a garment. Their eyes swell out through fatness. Their hearts overflow with follies. They scoff and speak with malice. Loftily, they threaten oppression. They set their mouths against the heavens, and their tongues struts through the earth. Therefore, his people turn back to them and find no fault in them. And they say, how can God know? Is there a knowledge in the Most High? Behold, these are the wicked, always at ease. They increase in riches. All in vain have I kept my heart clean and washed my hands in innocence. For all the day long I have been stricken and rebuked every morning. If I had said I will speak thus, I would have betrayed the generation of your children. But when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task. Until I went into the sanctuary of God, then I discovered their end. Truly you set them in slippery places. You make them fall to ruin. How they are destroyed in a moment, swept away utterly by terrors. Like a dream when one awakens, O Lord, when you rouse yourself, you despise them as phantoms. When my soul was embittered, when I was pricked in the heart, I was brutish and ignorant. I was like a beast towards you. Nevertheless, I am continually with you. You hold my right hand. You guide me with your counsel, and afterward you will receive me to glory. Whom have I in heaven but you? There is nothing on earth that I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. For behold, those who are far from you shall perish, and you put an end to everyone who is unfaithful to you. But for me, it is good to be near God. I have made the Lord my refuge, that I may tell of all your works. And I just thought that was a really helpful way to kind of summarize the book of Ecclesiastes here. Just somebody who saw the prosperity of the wicked and just... He said, I almost stumbled, my steps nearly slipped. I was arrogant, and just goes into all these things. But then he says, near the middle, he says, but then I thought I'd understand this. It seemed a wearisome task until I went into the sanctuary of God. Then I discerned their end. And it was that same kind of a thing we see at the very end of Ecclesiastes, when there is the recognition of fear God, obey him. And that's where it comes to. You have to look above the sun. And so that kind of an hour long summary of Ecclesiastes, and hopefully that was helpful. Two books that I'll recommend. I put them in the link to the handout. One, Living Life Backwards. You can see that. This one is by David Gibson. It's right now it's $10 on Christian Book for an ebook. You all have lots of time, probably being quarantined. You can probably get through this. It's a fairly short little book. The other one is Death by Living by N.D. Wilson, and that's, I think, $5 on Amazon for an ebook right now. Both are great, and they're really, really similar to one another. N.D. Wilson's Death by Living is a little bit more creative, a little bit less expositional. It's kind of a more just kind of musical whimsing Ecclesiastes in some ways, whereas Living Life Backwards is a much more expositional kind of look through the text in a much more kind of scholarly expositional way. Both are great, and we're next week is really kind of, I'll be delving into what those two books kind of deal with in Ecclesiastes, just living life in light of what Ecclesiastes has to teach us. So that's kind of, if anybody has the desire to read either of those books, that'd be great, and then you'll be really primed for our discussion next week. Any closing thoughts or questions before I end in prayer? Obviously, yeah. You can connect with me afterwards.
So I was wondering if the fear God at the very end in chapter 12, if that fear is more of the proverbial fear that you mentioned before, or is it still the ecclesiastical version of fear?
That's a good point. I think it's much more of the proverbial fear. I think because now we have this third person narrator coming in and reflecting back on the words of the struggling preacher. So I think it is the proverbial sense of just the right sense of fear. I think that's a really good question, though. Any others? Yeah, good one.
Jeff, I have a question. I can't raise my hand. You said, you know, the wisdom in Ecclesiastes is not, it's a different kind of wisdom than in Proverbs. And you said one of the reasons it's different is that it's more godless. Would you say it's contrary wisdom, or it's like.
You muted yourself, Tim.
Would you say it's contrary wisdom, or would you say it's more limited in that it's godless? Like, is it more like overlapping partially, or is it contrary? If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I wouldn't say that it's contrary. I think even as we look at what the third person narrator at the end of chapter 12 says, he says, you know, I'll read the King James version again, because I think that was helpful. He says, the preacher was wise. He still taught the people knowledge. Yes, he pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find acceptable words, and what was written was upright, words of truth. And so I think the reflection that we get there at the end, it doesn't say that it was bad. It wasn't contrary to the wisdom of God. It was just inadequate, I think. And I think that's what the preacher in the narrative comes to realize is this wisdom is inadequate. It's not enough because his wisdom is greater, and we can never know these things. But yeah, I think that's an interesting question. Yeah, others or. All right. Well, if anybody has any further ones, you can connect with me by email or, you know, call me, or I can stay on a little bit after this, obviously. But I'm looking forward to next week, and let me close us in prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this time together this evening just to study your word and just for what we've heard out of the book of Ecclesiastes, and just pray that it would be helpful for us, even as we go into this week, as a lot of us are quarantined and at home and or not working from our normal places and are isolated, and just we may be struggling. And I just pray that you would help us to just not try to deal with things from a worldly perspective, that we would bring everything into subjection under your word and under your truth. And we are thankful for that. And we just thank you for the time we've had this evening, and again, for this technology to be able to do it this way. And I just pray that you would keep us all healthy and safe as we go about this next week, and just help us to be in prayer for one another and in fellowship in whatever ways we can, God. And we're just thankful for this body of believers that we have. In Jesus' name, amen.